This is a HeadGum Original.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Connor, this is essentially a serial podcast, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, this is journalism.
I'm trying to get a Peabody Award.
Ooh, but like P-E-E-body, right?
Yeah, an off-brand Peabody Award with no A.
Yeah, a little piss boy award, Peabody.
Yeah.
We're recording this right now?
Yeah.
This is good. This is good stuff. What else can I help you with?
Oh, no, I think this will be really easy, but although maybe not.
I'm talking to my good friend Shannon O'Neill, who was one of my first improv teachers when I started taking classes back in 2009 at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York City.
Do you remember when I first told you the Tom Hanks story, Shannon, or when you first heard it?
I remember the first time you told me, the second time you told me, the third time I heard it, the fourth time you told me.
By 2011, Shannon and I were teammates and colleagues, performing together on stage at the UCB Theater and on the Chris Gethard Show on public access and later cable television.
The fifth time I walked in on you telling somebody that you already told, the sixth time...
You might recognize her as Marla Bevers on Broad City. You might have seen her in a recurring role on HBO's High Maintenance or as the notorious Sonia Farrick on the Netflix true crime miniseries How to Fix a Drug Scandal.
The seventh time I said it to somebody else and then they're like, oh, I want to hear you tell me, Connor.
Shannon has had my back on stage and in real life more times than I can count.
And then the eighth time when a piece of toast looked like Tom Hanks was in the UCB green room and you told it. I don't remember the first time you told me, but I remember you telling me. I've heard the story so many times, I feel like I might be Tom Hanks.
Shannon was also one of the reasons that my Tom Hanks Band of Brothers story started to spread beyond the small circle of people I knew personally.
Oh no, I outed you? That's rude.
I think I had told it on a podcast, but podcasts sometimes feel more private than they are. I mean, anyone can listen to them, but I also feel like you can say a secret, and if you say it on the right podcast, no one will hear it, you know?
Correct.
You were the first person to make the story public, I think, in a way that felt...
Oh, did I do it on Gethard Show?
Yeah, it was the episode that Amy Poehler was on.
Yes!
I had failed to win the presidency...
I had done an 18-month-long bit on the show in 2011 to 2012, where I ran for president. My entire platform was that I was 35 years old, a.k.a. old enough to be president. And when I failed to win the election, I immediately transformed the bit into a pledge that I would win at least one gold medal in the 2016 Summer Olympics.
Wait, that was a bit?
Yeah, it was always a bit.
Fuck.
So... in the middle of a live, entirely unscripted segment on The Chris Gethard Show, Shannon made a reference to me being fired by Tom Hanks, which to most of the people there, most of the people who were watching, was a total non sequitur.
And I think everyone is using a magic eight ball to predict people's futures.
Yeah.
And you predicted that...
Mine says you'll get to the opening ceremonies, but then Tom Hanks will replace you.
It got like a knowing laugh from the people in the room who had heard the story. What it required was for me to explain what the context of the joke was.
Do you want to reveal to the world what Tom Hanks told you or no?
He said, I didn't say it to me. I was told I have dead eyes.
So this podcast... is because of me.
In some ways, yeah, because...
Wow. What else have I created? Just kidding. I'm just being an asshole right now.
We won't make you look bad, I promise. Especially since you're...
The point is, Shannon has a way of making things happen. And when she brought up my Tom Hanks story on live TV, it sort of transformed it from this weird little show business secret from my past into more of a comedy bit that I couldn't escape from. She was also instrumental in helping me book one of the key jobs that set me on a path towards returning to show business as a professional actor, a decade and a half after my Band of Brothers disaster.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
I'm Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 20 years ago,
I was fired from Band of Brothers.
This is true.
That's a true fact.
You were an actor.
I didn't do anything wrong. Just the day before I was supposed to film my scene, I got... And what I kind of wanted a more military type.
That's fair.
There was a draft in World War II. There's a team.
And that's the short version. If you're a fan of the HBO original series Veep starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I have a small role in an episode of that show. A really memorable episode, actually, near the end of season 4 called Testimony, which was written and directed by series creator Armando Iannucci. But if you go back and watch it, you won't see me in it. It's an off-screen role. You can just hear my voice as an off-camera attorney during a series of deposition videos.
He said he takes care of your sanitary needs. Is that correct?
Yeah. What?
Do you not see the conflict of interest? I mean, we are investigating direct links between lobbyists and your administration.
Yes, I see it.
Does it not concern
you? But I don't.
You?
If you would just let me finish my sentence, that would be very much appreciated.
I got the job in the weirdest way. I just received an email out of nowhere. This was back in the year 2014.
Hi, Connor. We wanted to check on your availability for Veep. They're still working on the script, but this would be for a role that is off-camera, asking questions to the series regulars. It shoots in Baltimore December 8th and 9th. Are you available those dates? Do you have an agent or manager that I should be sending this inquiry to? Best, Peter.
At one point, I recall thinking that maybe it was a scam to get my social security number or something. Because it sounded fake. An off-camera speaking role? And I don't need to audition? The part is just mine? I can have it? But I checked around and found out that it was legit. That Veep star Matt Walsh, one of the founders of UCB, had asked for the artistic director to recommend a handful of performers. That was all it took. I got the part.
Walsh said, "Send me a list of 3 or 4 amazing improvisers who might play an off-camera interviewer for a Veep episode." And I, you know what? I said, "Fuck you, Walsh," and I sent him 5.
Was I number 5 on the list? Like, if it had been 3 or 4, would you think I would have made the cut?
I don't remember. I mean, you were number 1. I listed you first.
Number 1.
But I don't think that matters. I think it's just...
I think it matters to be number 1.
Yeah, it was November 18th, 2014 at 9:46 p.m. Matt Walsh emailed me. And when did I respond? 10:32 p.m. That's right. I was always working.
All right.
So what you really needed from me was just to say, yes, that's true. And then this we could have been done.
I think the minimum would have been, Shannon, was my name on the list that you gave to Matt Walsh?
And I would have said yes.
Can we just get it clean?
Okay.
Wow, I love this. Revisiting something that is so significant to you, and yet... We're all narcissists. We're like, I don't remember.
I never met Matt Walsh before doing my part on Veep. By the time I had started taking classes and performing at UCB New York, he and the other 3 founders of the theater had already relocated to LA, so they weren't around as often. And I didn't meet him during the shoot either. All I knew at the time was that he was the one who had asked Shannon for a list.
Well, yeah, I was always happy to have UCB blood in the show, and they were friendly to improv, so I'd always look for opportunities or poke my nose in and try to cast folks from the theater. So I don't know if I get full credit for pulling you into that specifically, but I'm sure I delivered up the notes that you came to the top of Shannon's mind. Like, I think it's exactly, you know, your skill set.
We didn't have to memorize anything. We didn't have to dress up like lawyers. We would just sit off camera and... Armando would sit next to me, and sometimes he'd just lean over and say, "Why don't you ask about this?" Or he'd sort of like write on the fly different directions for the lawyers to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, well, this is great because Armando's one of my heroes. And, you know, when I was in drama school in England, I was obsessed with I'm Alan Partridge.
Oh, my God. Me too.
I was like tracking down like everything that I could find that he had to do with. So I was thinking this will set me up that when they're thinking of anybody for the next season, I will maybe come to mind. And of course, like two episodes after that, Armando's back in England. The show has moved to L.A. Like that move of Veep from Baltimore to L.A. and Armando no longer being the showrunner meant like, oh, well, that was the one person that I felt like I was impressing. And I thought, oh, well, maybe they'll bring me back if they have an on-camera, like, small role or something.
Well, you're absolutely right to assume that. That is how the show functioned. I'm sure you did impress him because I know you're funny. And I'm sure he was, like, excited about a new toy in a way. Like, oh, my God, this guy has such a great take. Like, he thought that way when he met talent. So I don't think you were wrong to be excited about that.
My only TV show experiences at that point, obviously, there was the Band of Brothers experience in the year 2000, and then there's a long, long gap before I do anything else. Like, when I did Broad City, it wasn't a show yet. It hadn't aired on Comedy Central, whereas Veep was the first time that I was on a set of a show that I was already invested in the fictional universe of the show.
And you didn't blow it.
And I didn't blow it, and it was a real honor to be a part of it, and yet I'm still off camera. It felt like, we won't let you on. You can't be on the show, but you can be in the show. Like, when I was telling people, like, yeah, watch this episode of Veep. And I'm like, you won't see me. And they're like, you kind of have to explain, like, I'm an off-camera attorney and you'll hear me. You'll recognize my voice, you know.
The whole experience was very fun, very positive. But there was one aspect to it that I didn't even know about at the time. Something I would learn a few years later that would add a small ripple of intrigue to the entire thing, which is that one of Veep's biggest fans is Tom Hanks.
He sent us all a letter when we were on the show, how much he loved the show. He gave us each a typewritten letter and basically said, "You're comedy lords, I bow down to you." He was very like humble and like worshipy. It was very sweet and a historic moment, obviously. Like, that's like getting a letter from Abraham Lincoln. Like, you know, we have to never lose this. Like, confirmation of my connection to Tom Hanks, who thinks I'm a genius. Like, this is unbelievable.
It's so funny how show business is just like a moderate-sized small town's worth of people.
Comedy is also an even smaller subset in a way. You're just fortunate that if you're nice, it all doesn't come back to bite you. Do you know what I mean? Like, before you realize that lesson of how small it is, if you were just, your default position is just be nice to people, then you'll be okay.
When we return, I'll be talking with Matt's Veep co-star, Tony Hale. One of the worst nights sleep I ever had was the night right after I got fired from Band of Brothers. I had rented a room in a youth hostel in London for the week I was scheduled to film. And it was a small room with a not great mattress. I was up all night, stewing about what had happened. I can't help thinking that if maybe I'd gotten a good night's sleep that night on a mattress that felt right for me, maybe I would have gotten over it more quickly. And finding the right mattress for you is easy now. Helix Sleep has a quiz you can take online. It's really quick, takes about 2 minutes, and they can tell you exactly which mattress is right for your body type and sleep preference. Now, everybody's different, and Helix knows that, so they have several different kinds of mattresses to choose from. They have soft, medium, firm mattresses, mattresses to cool you down if you sleep hot, even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-size folks. I took the Helix quiz, and I was matched with the Midnight Luxe mattress because I wanted something that would accommodate tossing and turning. It was neither too soft nor too firm. So if you're looking for a mattress, you take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store ever again. Which is especially great right now because, honestly, who wants to go to a mattress store to test out mattresses in the middle of a pandemic, right? My mattress is on its way, but I am confident I'm going to like it based on its reputation. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ and Wired magazine. Just go to helixsleep.com/deadeyes Take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it. But you will. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. That's up to $200 off all mattress orders plus 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/deadeyes. We'll probably talk about this in a future episode, but have you seen the movie Larry Crown? It was Tom Hanks' second film as a writer-director, co-written with Nia Vardalos, and in it, Tom Hanks plays a guy, Larry Crown, who gets fired. And the whole first, like, half hour of the film is about how depressed and confused he is about getting fired. Interesting, right? But then, he does something about it. He takes a public speaking class, and it changes his whole life. He finds this whole new community of friends. This episode is sponsored by Skillshare, an online community where millions come together to take the next step in their creative journey. There are thousands of classes available on topics including illustration, design, photography, video, freelancing, and more, including a whole bunch of different classes in public speaking, from beginner-level courses for people who are terrified of it to more advanced options like stand-up comedy or how to give your own TED Talk. I mean, that's the Larry Crown way. My way of dealing with being fired was to make this podcast. And they have classes on how to do that, too. They honestly have so many different kinds of classes, it's really impressive. It reminds me of when I decided I wanted to start taking improv classes. I had been in a rut creatively, and what finally convinced me to do it was I thought to myself, I can just try one and see if I like it. And looking at all the different options on Skillshare, there's a class called Improvising Comics: Techniques to Generate Funny Ideas by John McNamee. It's 8 lessons, 23 minutes total. So it's very easy to try it out and see if it's right for you. And it's also really affordable. If you get an annual subscription, it's less than $10 a month. Explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/deadeyes. And the first 1,000 people to use our link will get a free trial of Skillshare Premium Membership. That's a free trial of Skillshare Premium Membership for the first 1,000 people to use our link. Skillshare.com/deadeyes.
Have you still kind of not had any vegetables?
No, I have vegetables all the time. I just never enjoy them. They're
just awful.
I treat them like medicine.
I'm talking with Tony Hale, who played the role of Gary on Veep and also Buster Bluth on Arrested Development. Now, I don't know him well enough to confidently say we're friends, but, and that feels presumptuous and makes me feel nervous to say it out loud like that on a podcast. But you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say it. I think we might be friends.
Uh-huh.
I mean, at this point, it's more about the discipline of, like, I don't like it, but I'll never eat vegetables for pleasure. I just eat them for medicine.
Yeah, I get that.
I know I need to eat them, and I know that there's nothing I like to eat that my body needs, but there are a lot of things that I like to eat that are just killing me.
Sure, I get it. What's like, can you hear the trolley? That was the San Francisco trolley.
What we're referring to here is the time that I interviewed him for an hour for a brief segment on the Chris Gethard Show. It's a video you can find online where I was forced to eat vegetables in order to be allowed to ask him detailed questions about Arrested Development.
Oh no, I have many more questions than I think I could possibly eat. These are Brussels sprouts, yes? Does it count?
Totally counts. Oh.
The front of my tongue probably hasn't tasted a vegetable in 15 years.
The front of your tongue?
Front of my tongue.
Tony won 2 Emmys for his work on Veep, so he is most definitely one of the lords of comedy referenced in the typewritten note from Tom Hanks. And while Hanks never made a cameo appearance on Veep, he does sort of play a role on the show without ever appearing on camera. I don't want to ruin it for people who haven't seen it yet, but there is an offhand reference to Hanks in the very first episode that comes back in the series finale in a very satisfying way.
Yeah, a really great button, and they're shooting it, and then somebody's like, did we even ask Tom if we can do this? And so they sent him an email, and he was like, of course.
It occurs to me hearing that means that Tom Hanks has watched a TV show that has my voice on it, but not my eyes.
My face was never seen on Veep. So there's, it's an, I remember when I got that little part in Veep, I was like, well, this is my second opportunity to be on an HBO show, but it's still nowhere near getting my face onto HBO, getting those dead eyes onto the HBO signal.
I think the first thing I ever saw Tony Hale in was probably the 1999 Mr. Roboto Volkswagen commercial, which would later be spoofed on an episode of Arrested Development. And part of the reason that we did that vegetable-eating interview was that it was known that I was such an early and vocal fan of that show. I used to post all the time on a website called Television Without Pity, where Mitch Hurwitz, the creator of the show, along with a lot of the writers and cast, would lurk to see how people were reacting to each new episode.
It was a place where we felt like at least certain people were getting what we felt like we were getting from it. You know, like, well, at least they were getting it.
Yeah, it felt like it was like a place where people watching the show would leave notes for the people who were making the show, and you'd go see those notes. Like, there definitely started to be a dialogue between this message board and the show, in that jokes started showing up on TV that you felt like the only people who might get these very tiny jokes were people who were that actively involved in the message boards. There started being things where a number would appear in an episode and everyone on the message boards would start obsessing about what that number meant.
Oh, I love that. And actually, I remember, because weren't you like middleman, or what was the name you had?
I was middleman.
Right.
So when a character shows up in season three whose name is Larry Middleman, that has a clear meaning for the show, but that's also my handle on Television Without Pity.
Did everybody else on the message boards mention it?
I think it might have been someone else who started pointing it out, and then I was like, maybe? And then,
what did Mitch say when we texted him during that last interview?
I think he just texted, "I love him," when you asked about me, because he remembered that I was a booster of the show. And then a couple of years later, he basically confirmed it on Twitter that I was the original middleman.
Oh, come on. That's cool.
Tony has come by UCB to watch ASCAD. He's been a guest on my George Lucas talk show live stream while he was stuck in a hotel room quarantining in Toronto. He's someone who will just every now and then send a message saying something nice. So Tony is someone I feel comfortable reaching out to. And the fact that he co-starred with Tom Hanks in Toy Story 4 as Forky felt like another good reason to talk to him. At least that was my thought. I had a whole long list of questions about what it was like acting opposite Tom Hanks.
No, we never recorded together.
You're kidding me.
I want to say not. I don't know if anybody did this time, but they might have done it in the other Toy Stories, but in this, we all recorded individually. And so the director would just bounce the lines off of you and you would, you know, do various versions of it. There was one time I remember I was going into record and Tom Hanks had just recorded before me and he was walking out as I was walking in, but never recorded together.
That's amazing to me because it feels like there's such chemistry in the movie that is just a trick of, you know, professional acting and recording trickery.
You know, we did a lot of different versions for each line. So, I mean, I'm sure it took a lot of work to really find the matches of what would work since we weren't in the same room.
Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly a hot take to say that the people at Pixar know what they're doing by now. Like, these guys know how to make these. So my assumption is then that you probably interacted more with him when you're like promoting the movie than actually making it. It's funny because my actual interaction with him was so nice, except for the actual circumstances of what it was, which was I, for whatever reason, was not like right for this thing. And I was also like crazy in my head because of what the person in my agent's office had said to me.
Isn't it amazing though, like the power of words, like for that assistant, even if it wasn't true, for them to say something like that, like, we really underestimate the power of these words. You know, I remember somebody years ago, and I don't have that great of a resonance, but there was this acting teacher who was like, Tony, you have, you know, no resonance to your voice, like was so demeaning. And those words, man, are very, very powerful. And unfortunately in Hollywood, people don't, and I think anywhere actually, they don't value their words. They throw them out. They'll even throw them out to like not burn bridges or whatever without, they'll say like, oh yeah, 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 without knowing that they meant no, like it's not going to happen. But people cling on to that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like say what, there's a lot of integrity to someone whose yes is yes and their no is no. And that's, words aren't really treated as precious as they should be. And by the way, Connor, you do not have dead eyes, just FYI.
Did you ever have any really big disappointments starting out as an actor?
Oh, yeah. And I still do.
Really?
I think, yeah, it's always a hustle. Because I moved to New York in 95. And because I don't know if you remember, you're younger than I am, but there was a magazine called Backstage that you would get.
Yeah.
And then you would circle all these possible jobs. But I just kind of had a ton of jobs, a ton of like, you know, just to make the ends meet jobs. And then I would do theater on the side. And then I started getting into commercials. But it took me 7 years to find an agent to represent me for TV and film.
Wow.
And every time pilot season would go by, just that frustration of missing, feeling like I'm missing opportunities. And the weird thing about it is like typically in life, people do a job interview for 2 or 3 months and then they have a job for 2 or 3 or however many years. In our business, you're on a job interview for 2 or 3 years and then you're lucky to get a gig for 2 or 3 months. Like it's, you're always on a job interview and there's only one person for the job. So rejection and disappointment is a part of what you sign up for.
And weirdly, there's an unusual sort of, the way that the sort of show business ecosystem works is the less you need it, the more it wants you. And the more you need it, the more it will kind of like reject you.
For me, it comes in waves. You know, it's like sometimes I feel like I'm really good at it and I'm like, all right, press on. And then other days when you really, really do want something and it doesn't work out, it's like, all right, I'm going to be pretty disappointed today and then move on tomorrow. You know, it's like kind of giving yourself rather than, well, I remember, I guess it was like 5 years ago, I was supposed to do this really great movie in North Korea.
Wow, you're going to film in North Korea?
Well, no, sorry, we weren't going to film in North Korea, but it was, no, I let me take that back. It took place in North Korea, but we were going to film someplace else, like Budapest or something.
Gotcha.
And without saying names, it was like really great names were involved and this director, and I met with the director, and I was just like, I had that same moment of like, all right, this is really exciting, gave it a lot of weight. And then the interview came out with Randall Park and all that kind of stuff. And there was all this controversy about it. I don't know if you remember. And right after Christmas, I got a phone call saying they're not doing the movie. It was just like, what? Like, I was like, what's going on?
Just a quick note in case you're out of the loop here. The James Franco, Seth Rogen feature film The Interview was a comedy about a fictional U.S. attempt to assassinate the leader of North Korea. And in case Seth is listening to this episode, hi Seth. I want you to know your name came up organically. I promise we're not trying to turn this into a recurring segment. Tony is fine. Please don't feel obligated to reach out. Sorry this keeps happening.
It was another one of those lessons where I'm sure you experienced this too. It's just like, I have no control over this. I am completely powerless to this situation. And for me to jump on a train of frustration, I mean, I can be frustrated. We're allowed those feelings. We're allowed to walk through those feelings.
We need those feelings sometimes.
And we need those feelings. We need to express that. But when I keep jumping on this feeling train with something that is completely out of my control, it's like I got to a place where it's like, I need to sit more in the powerlessness of the situation and be like, I am powerless to this. This is out of my control. And now I just have to keep walking. But it's like, the more that happens, as hard as it is, it's more of a gift where it's like, you know what? It's not just this job. It's life. We're completely powerless to so many things. And there's some joy in kind of sitting in that powerlessness rather than sitting in this place of like, how I can control the way people think. I have this kind of control. There's so much that's out of our control.
I also find I have to remind myself, because I still think, you know, when I talk to an actor like you, that there's a magical level that you can get to where everything will be okay.
I love the story when Jim Carrey, maybe it was the Golden Globes, and he had won two previously or something like that. And he came out and in his speech, he said,
"And when I dream, I don't just dream any old dream. I dream about being three-time Golden Globe winning actor Jim Carrey. Because then I would be enough."
They switched to the audience and everybody laughed, but I'm sure there's still that part in all of us that think, oh, but if I do this, it will be enough. It will be all okay. And the fact is, it's never enough. It's never enough, and it's a constant lesson to all of us to be like, hey, let's wake up to what's around us. Let's practice being present. You and I, we're the most known we're ever going to be and ever going to need if people who are close to us know us and love us. That's the most known we're ever going to need. You know, it's just all of those kind of daily lessons I have to wake up to.
It's also one of those things where it's like, if you're always focused on the next thing without appreciating the thing that you're currently involved in, it'll never be enough. It'll, you know, sometimes it's like when you watch someone who's like super rich and they're trying to get richer and you're like, don't you realize that you have so much?
And they don't. And that's what this children's book I did was about. You know, it's because I when I booked Arrested Development those many years ago, here I was on a great gig, my dream gig, and it didn't satisfy me the way I thought it was going to satisfy. I mean, it scared me. It had nothing to do with the show, nothing to do with the actors. Mm-hmm. It was all the weight I had given it, and I was still looking to my next thing. And it's like, if you're not practicing contentment where you are, you're not going to be content when you get what you want. And I had felt like I had not been practicing being present for most of my life. So this little chicken in the book gets a card in the mail that says, your big thing is here. And he's like, where? And he goes on all these adventures. But every time he's on a great adventure, he's like, I got to get to my next big thing. And this bee travels around with him and is like, you got to just be, man. You got to just be. And then in the end, he realizes that the card is right, that your big thing is right here. My big thing right now is talking to you. That's my big thing. And I have to wake up to that every single day. Which, by the way, it's easy to talk about this too. I suck at it. But I think I talk about it a lot because it's like, it's a reminder for me.
I talked to the actor who ended up replacing me on Band of Brothers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he's someone that I told him, I said, you know, for a couple of years after it happened, because I kind of backed away and I wasn't pursuing show business or anything, and I would check his IMDb every now and then, almost as if I was checking to see, like, what my life would have been. There was a point that I realized in talking to him that within a decade of me getting fired from that part and him getting that part, I was working at a bookstore in New York City and he was working at a bookstore in Canada. And we both felt the exact same way. We both felt like, oh, we blew it. We blew it.
But here's the greater truth. Even if that guy went on to win 5 Oscars and became whatever, that does not equate joy. That does not equate real living. If anything, these lessons where you grab onto that self-awareness and really see things around you and really try to wake yourself up and see each other and love each other, whatever, like that's where the joy is. That's the equation.
And also like trying to find what's also fun or funny about how insane this industry can be sometimes, you know?
Yeah, totally.
The number of times that I've auditioned for parts where the description of the character is viscerally insulting to the actor auditioning for it. Where you get a job offer that is basically just like, we're looking for a repulsive looking creep.
Yeah, I'll one up that. The best is when they use your name to describe a type. So my friend was auditioning for something and it was like a Tony Hale type. And then in the description it was like, you know, like an emasculated nobody. And it's like, oh, all right. Well, I don't consider. You could maybe attach that to Buster or Gary, but I don't know if you need to put my name in there.
Have you ever had an experience of being cut from a film where you didn't find out until you saw the thing? Like, oh, they didn't use this or they didn't.
Not a film, but I do remember a couple times. I remember when I was in New York and I got, you know, just trying to find gigs, and Conan O'Brien wanted me to, or I got the role, some role on Conan O'Brien to play. Do you remember that movie Shine with Jeffrey Rush?
Yes.
Well, they were doing a parody of it, and I was playing Jeffrey Rush at the piano, and I told all of my family to stay up, and at that time there was no DVR or anything like that, so they all stayed up until like 11:30 at night or whenever it airs. Needless to say, I was cut. And I was like, you know what? Until it is on the screen, until I'm actually on this, you know, it's, I just don't mention it. I just don't, unless I absolutely know it is coming out, I don't ever say anything.
Yeah, you learned that the hard way, because when you tell everybody, then it means a lot to them. They get focused on it, and then you end up having to like answer a lot of questions and, you know.
Oh, yeah, and not to mention my family who told their friends.
Yeah, it spreads like wildfire.
You know, they tell my relatives and like, oh my gosh, and they call me Anthony. Anthony's going to be on Conan tonight. Anthony's going to be da-da-da-da-da. And so then they're getting, not only am I getting questions, they're getting questions like, oh, I didn't see Anthony. And it's like, oh God, now I'm putting everybody in chaos. I don't know. It's tricky. It really is this weird uncertainty we walk in, this kind of walk of faith. And I always tell, like, you know, when I talk to students or whatever about the like what advice I would give them, and I always say, invest in your community before you invest in your career, because it's your community that's going to keep you, give you longevity, because they're the people that are going to see you for who you are when the business, you know, you're just a number sometimes.
That took me a long time to figure that out. You know,
well, it's really like, that's the only thing that I really survived was the community that I had gracefully been given when I was in New York, just my good friends, and that I could just, you know, come back and be like frustrated, but then they just kind of encourage me on and see me for who I am. And it was just everything to me. That's totally what kept me going.
There's a period of time in my life that I sometimes think of as my wilderness years, starting in the year 2000 when I quit acting, and lasting roughly a decade or so. And it's not like I was living in the woods, foraging for food and trying to make fire, castaway style. It's that I had more or less removed myself from the civilization of show business, if you want to call it that, and wandered away from the profession I had spent my life pursuing up until getting fired from Band of Brothers. Originally, the reason I had to tell people my Tom Hanks Deadeye story wasn't because it was funny or interesting. It was because I had already told them that I was going to be in Band of Brothers. So I had to explain to them that it wasn't going to be happening anymore. And why. It was obligatory. And it was embarrassing. Now, I had people who were on my side, who were sympathetic, friends and family. It's not like I was going through it all alone. But there was something missing. Because what Tony talked about, investing in your community before investing in your career, I hadn't totally done that yet. And it took me a long time to try. To reach out from the wilderness, posting on internet message boards, trying to connect with a TV show from a distance as a fan. To make myself vulnerable on stage in an improv class, meeting people who were on the outskirts like me, trying to find a way in. People who could see what was funny about being fired by Tom Hanks. People who would blurt the story out, unprompted, during the live taping of a television show.
You no longer have to be sad about this, and now you can, don't make it your weakness, make it your power.
It kind of is like me reclaiming the experience as a different thing.
Yes.
We've been on an improv team for almost a decade,
mm-hmm.
Although I'm still counting the time during pandemic in which improv doesn't exist.
We're still on an improv team together.
I'm still counting it towards the total.
For life, bro. Don't you remember when we both pissed in each other's mouths?
Yep, I do remember.
We did a little piss siblings instead of like blood brothers, you know, we did piss siblings.
Really campaigning hard for that Peabody Award. Even by that point, that was relatively early in our span of our performing together. We were already at a point where you were one of the people that I trusted. Like, you knew when you revealed it that it would be something that would be fun and good for me and not a thing that I'd afterwards be like,
Shannon, why did you say that? You embarrassed me in front of Amy Poehler.
You're like bringing a memory very like to the front of my brain. And I remember wanting Amy to know who you were.
Oh, interesting.
I know I'm like teasing you in that loving way that I tease you, but also I'm revealing this kind of like very interesting specific fact about you because you hadn't really met her before, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah, that was like your first time meeting her. So it's like, oh, Connor's doing this like this silly thing of like training to be in the Olympics. But it's like, I think Amy should know that he did stuff before this. Like, he's actually also like a real actor who's not just like, he's not just a clown in metallic pants.
By far the funniest part of the bit that I did that night was you derailing it and me talking about something that I had genuinely not planned on like talking about on the show, you know? So thank you.
I mean, that's improv, right? The unplanned.
Yeah.
And you had to give your elevator pitch of it.
Yeah.
Not your normal 30-minute version.
I knew that Gethard was only going to allow me a certain window in which to tell the story. And if I said, well, you see, I had done a series of auditions. You know, if I started, it basically would have been the pilot episode of this podcast.
I moved to London and I was in an actor's conservatory.
Yeah.
And now I'm in my own childhood fort doing a podcast.
Yeah.
Do you name each podcast? Like, do you give it a title?
Yeah.
Can you call this one Piss Siblings?
I promise you. I promise. Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Special thanks to my guests Shannon O'Neill, Matt Walsh, and Tony Hale. And thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use this song that's playing in the background. It's from her 2012 album, Charmer. It's a great record. If you don't already own a copy, maybe go to amymann.com and buy one. Or order one from your local independent record store. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email address is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, whose performance in the film Charlie Wilson's War is, I think, probably the most Veep-like thing he's done. Obviously, Aaron Sorkin is a very different writer than Armando Iannucci, but it's still the thing that popped into my head when I was thinking about Hanks's love for Veep. I can imagine programming a double bill of Charlie Wilson's War and Iannucci's In the Loop, which came out 2 years later. Both sharp films about politicians making deals and waging war, and unintended consequences. I would love to see Tom Hanks in a film by Armando Iannucci. Can someone make that happen? And if it does, let them know I am available, even for roles that are entirely off camera. See you next time. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Everybody's got the differences.
Was a HeadGum original.